And it is best if this be quite informal, so you know, feel free to stop me and ask questions. What I wanted to do here is kind of look towards the future, tell you about there are kind of three levels of project. There's one that's approved, which is mounting this 15 kilograms in the existing facility, which we're doing as fast as we can, and that'll be running sometime into summer, fall, something like that. And then there is finally some real momentum for setting up a facility at Snow Lab. The Particle Astro Scientific Assessment Group that met recently had a fairly strong endorsement. That's not necessary, well, that's not sufficient, but it is necessary for the next step in the approval process. And then interestingly, the ton scale experiment at DUSO, we actually have money for, because the NSF put money into this S4 process. So we have money for the ton scale. We don't yet have the R&D funds for the 100 kilogram. But anyway, these are the strange aspects. And then the thing I really am very excited to tell you some about is this new interleaved zip detector design, which is from the data that we got from the prototype device earlier this year. It's a huge detector advance, and it really enables all the way to the ton scale with the existing technology. So that's exciting for us. There was a hiccup on the archive, so this is actually the number of the one that will appear today instead of yesterday.
Can we ask what the hiccup was?
Yeah, the hiccup was that when the file was entered into the archive, the bibliography attachment wasn't in the TAR file, and so it went through making the PDF but failed at some point down the line. So it looked like the PDF was all right, but you needed to look all the way through to see that it had...
There were no references? Was that the problem?
Yeah, apparently the automatic process, if it doesn't successfully complete the PDF with the references, it just essentially bounces you out of the system. So when we looked yesterday, there was another paper with the same number, and that's because the system had just bounced it out. It actually had sent Jody an email, but she was a little busy yesterday, and that was cleaned up then last night, and bibliography added, and a new number issued. And then it is available on the website here too, if you can't wait till 5 today. The other thing I thought I would do, I talked yesterday about the advance in the analysis where we had taken and optimized the cuts of all of the detectors independently, and this is just a little bit, saying a little bit more about that. So each detector we formed, this plot here, the green is the leakage, so the leakage percentage is along this line here, how many events you expect to leak. The dotted line is the cut we're going to place, and the blue line is the spectrum averaged exposure that you have. So as you make the cut more and more severe, you have less and less exposure. As you open up the cut, you have more and more exposure. Okay, so we parameterize this curve based on all of the calibration data, and you then parameterize for each one of the detectors the green curve associated with the smaller number of data you have for each detector. But you form kind of a functional form from all of it, and then you fit the coefficients to that form for each detector. And then the nice addition this time around was an automated optimization system where the cut was set separately for each of the detectors, the 14 or 15 in this case, and then all combined together into this plot down here. So this is the upper limit 90% confidence level as a function of the total leakage. So that's the 0.5 and the 0.6 events. Leakage. And the different curves are, there were actually 7 or 8 parallel treatments of the data that were done. And one was selected prior to unblinding. Because they were all very close together, we chose actually so-called classic timing cuts, which are the easiest to understand and report on. So that's what we ended up. But the differences were very small. And then this is running exactly the same process on the previous data set, the one that we had reported on in the previous PRL. This actually gave an improved limit by something like 30% because of the optimization process of the optimizing all of the detectors independently gives you about 30%. And then this is what the new data set prediction was for the estimated. So anyway, that's just a little bit more on how that process works.
This is all done without opening the signal engine.
All before unblinding, pre-unblinding analysis, right.
And it's based on calibration data taken during the dark matter run?
Yes, interspersed. In fact, every day about, well, actually, the routine became Monday, Wednesday, Friday calibrations for 2 hours, and then people were not going in the mine on Tuesday, Thursday, or the weekend. So, you know, that was the, and then about once every 2 months, there's a neutron calibration. So there are about 7 of those interspersed. Okay, and then just looking at the broader picture, Jody ended her talk with this, so that's the new combined limit that we have there, and then the 15 kilogram experiment that I'll tell you some more about has that kind of reach, and the 100 kilogram experiment, which is what we're targeting for Snow Lab, goes down a little more than order of magnitude, and then the ton scale, similar. Jump down. And then always, I mean, I always like to say in looking at these plots is that these are very nice plots. Each one of these steps down is has many, many potential pitfalls, right? The backgrounds find very ingenious ways to creep in, and you really don't know what you're going to find until you mount the next level experiment. So I would say that these are all vaporware until we actually demonstrate that we can get there. Right? But at least we believe that there's a good path to do that. This is where we are now. So we've completed the CDMS 2 runs. We are actually now running this first super tower with the new type detectors that I'll tell you about. And we plan to stop that probably in February, something like that, and then complete the fabrication of the remaining detectors and start running summer. Probably it'll be in the fall. So this is the detector fabrication step. And then really with the same fabrication team ramped up somewhat, we have these 4-inch diameter by 4/3 of an inch thick detectors that are going to be the baseline for the 100 kilogram experiment at Snow Lab. And the as I'll show you, this new design allows this same size detector to be ramped up to, instead of making 84 of them, you make 1,000 of them, and that gets you into the ton and a half scale. Okay, so that's one potential. We're also looking at the same time, and I won't say too much about this here, at being able to get crystals that are 6 inches, 150 millimeters in diameter instead of the 4. So we're pretty confident. Several companies have bid now to produce the 100 millimeter. Everything we've done so far is at this 76 millimeter diameter, and that gives us 1.5 kilograms per detector versus our the ones for this experiment are sitting at about 0.6 kilograms per detector. Okay, so that's, and then you can see the way you should always look at these plots is that this is the earliest these things will ever occur, right? And agencies will find ways to always stretch this out. And then just pictorially, so here's the cross-section of the detector. CDMS-2 that you heard reported on yesterday is 1 centimeter thick, 7.5. The ones that we're currently fabricating and we're running the first set of are 2.5 times thicker, so that gets to about the 0.6 kilograms per detector. And we actually have ordered the 100 millimeter in actually 100 and 111. I'll describe a little bit why we're interested in that. Different crystalline orientation for the Snow Lab, and potentially that could also do so, but we're going to explore the possibility of going to larger 5 kilograms per detector mass as well. So that's the, and then the Snow Lab, there are 7 towers of 12 detectors per tower, so that's the 84. Okay, so Sudan, so that's sometimes confusing. This we're using the Super CDMS. Originally, it was to be the Snow Lab experiment. The agencies dragged on, and they said, why don't you kind of demonstrate your technology and do it at the existing facility? So now this has become a formal project, Super CDMS Sudan, using the existing facility with the 15 kilograms. And this shows you what the first super tower looks like. That's physically it. And here's in cross-section, there are five. Our towers for CDMS-2 had six detector slots. Each one of these hexagonal faces had a 4 Kelvin amplifiers that ran down to each detector. And we chose kind of a clever way. What we found here, by the way, is that we always had for, the optimization that we described in that second view graph had relatively small fiducial volumes for the end caps. We had to cut them fairly severely because they don't have the vetoing aspect of having a detector right next to them. Okay, so in fact, the inner detectors in the stack had substantially more fiducial volume than the end cap detectors. And for most towers, the end cap detectors were germanium, so it doesn't matter whether it was silicon or germanium. It's just the fact that there was no vetoing from a next nearest neighbor. So with that, we said, well, why don't we do the new towers in such a way that we essentially eliminate end cap detectors? And what we've done is we've taken one of the channels here and turned it into an ionization plus half of the phonon channels. So one ionization channel, two phonon channels in an old CDMS-2 germanium detector at the bottom and one at the top. So those become our veto detectors. And then we have five inner germanium detectors that are of this new thickness. So that was kind of a clever way to avoid the end caps but still have larger fiducial volume than if we'd had two full detectors on the end caps. Right? We essentially eliminate one of them. Okay, and as I say here, we are now operating this guy in Sudan. Four of the five detectors are working very well. One of them had a wire that didn't survive the cool down. Okay, so that, and by the way, our rule of thumb on that is that it's science capable if you have more than 90% of the detectors fully functional when you cool down. So that's roughly the aim on these things always.
So are you punting silicon at this point?
Yes, we're punting silicon in the sense we have demonstrated silicon detectors in the laboratory. The science reach is substantially greater for germanium, and the ability to reject backgrounds, particularly the neutron ones, has gotten sufficiently good that the need for silicon versus germanium may rear its head when we see a signal, and we can compute how many, but we'd like to really push forward with the germanium to get the maximum science reach initially. Right? So that's the plan now. And the silicon is substantially less expensive per crystal, easier to manufacture. So when we need that, it's easy to do. And the development of the detector fabrication always involves building some silicon ones because it's a good thing to demonstrate first before going to the germanium. By the way, the germanium blanks for these detectors are about $14,000 each from Ortec. And when we go to the next larger one, there'll be of order $25,000 to $30,000 each. Okay, so that's the high purity material grown into crystal. And includes the polishing, but that's not too large a quantity. Okay, and then the other thing to say here is we are partway through fabricating the third super tower, and we'll progress through four and five. And I'll say it a little bit later on, the immediate wrinkle that we have before us as to whether or not to make some of these remaining super towers out of the new iZip technology. Okay, so that's a possibility which we've been encouraged to think about by several review committees, including PASAG. All right, so this is the CDMS-2 detectors, and we can show it here as well because they are the end caps of the new super towers. Right? We're using them for end caps with just instrumenting the inner and outer charge combined into one charge amplifier, and also wiring pairs of the four quadrants into two phonon channels. So we don't have the ability to do dark matter searches, but it's a very good veto detector. Okay, and let's see, I guess this wonders.
This is very technical, but actually how do you hold the germaniums in the frame?
Right, you can see it here actually that there's a capton. These are these Cyrillix, I think it's called, these sandwiches, they're actually adjusted for the slight variations in thickness so that we can clamp them. Right now, this has actually been a discussion that we actually clamp them with three clamps from the bottom and the other three from the top in between. And that actually does put more of a stress on the crystal than if you clamp them posing faces. So we've been wondering whether or not you could damage crystals from the differential contraction, et cetera, something to at least keep in mind.
It's not springy or anything. It's like more.
Not springy. It's actually, and the Cerelix probably becomes rather rock hard when you cool it down. So the other thing that I've been suggesting we look at is some Belleville washers and to actually provide a little bit of springiness in the clamp. Okay, and we'll say more about the design. You can see that there's kind of a trilobe structure here, which was a big, that was the second most important addition to the designs that we have. And there was an optimization in this design of the aluminum fins, and that's kind of shown here. The CDMS2 detectors had a what I call rectilinear design. In fact, the masks were made at a time when the mask making software didn't easily allow non-rectilinear designs. Now it's very easy to use vector definitions in your mask making software. So we've optimized. This little thin line that you can barely see in red there is the tungsten transition edge sensor. So it's 1.5 to 2 microns wide and typically 200 microns long. And we want to get as much aluminum collector fin. The aluminum fins absorb the phonons. The quasi-particle excitations in the aluminum fins then diffuse into the tungsten, heating the electron system in the tungsten. That's how this works. And this was a substantial advantage. We got twice as much aluminum, the same distance to the 1 micron line there than here, and so that means that you increase your phonon collection. It turns out the quasi-particle diffusion, for reasons we don't entirely understand, has about 180 microns, 1 over E, for being trapped locally. So when you're 180 microns away, 1 over E of the quasi-particles get to your TES. When you get longer, it exponentially gets attenuated. So you don't want these distances to be very much larger than about 180 microns. So that's the other. And then you can see here, each one of these coliseums is wired, in this case, in these circular designs where each TES has a parallel, they're wired in parallel with voltage rails made out of aluminum, which are superconducting, so there's no voltage drop across the aluminum. Okay, and then the other improvement, which was a very simple thing, but if you don't think about it, you don't realize that it's how valuable it is, was to take the four quadrants that we had in CDMS2, and the problem is, and I'll show you a little bit more about that, was that there is less and less information on the radial position as you move out close to the outside of this design. Okay, you get a good resolution on where you are close to the boundary of these guys. As you get out close to the outer perimeter, there's not much variation in the amount of energy collected in each sensor. So the very simple idea in order to improve that was to take these four equal area sensors, turn one of them into a ring all the way around the perimeter, and turn the other three into a trilobe, which still provides X and Y information. And that outer ring broke the degeneracy in terms of where you were radially. Okay? And that was tremendously valuable. We call this the Mercedes design, and this the BMW design. Okay, so this is a little bit more about that confusion. So in the CDMS2 analysis, you basically have two ways to characterize your radial position. One of them is by looking at the partitioning of energy into the four sensors, say an X and Y, and then developing a radius associated with that. The other one is to do it from the timing delay from one side to the other in X versus in Y. Okay, and the thing that allowed us to deconvolute that is when you plot one against the other, you see that the turnovers, neither of them are monotonic functions. They all have a maximum and then roll over, but that rollover occurs at different positions for the two. So when you plot one against another, you get the so-called shrimp plot, where where when you plot the radial position, the ones, for example, that are in Q outer are in this head, and then it rolls back over. But there is still a region of confusion where events in this region here can be misidentified as being further in radius than they actually are, or vice versa. Okay, and so there's a lot of work that went on in this last analysis, which I think is one of the reasons that we had so many fewer leakage events in general than in past analyses, and that's that the there are lookup tables that are made from large sets of calibration data, and you normalize the properties of each event based on the nearest neighbors within this lookup table. And in the past, we actually didn't include the Q outer in the lookup table. We just included Q inner. And that meant that when events were close to that Q outer boundary, it was particularly bad because we got some of these Q outer points leaking through here, but didn't have any good way to characterize their properties. So we just did the simple thing this time of including a significant amount of Q outer in the lookup table, and that substantially improved, reduced the leakage, because then a point in here had a significant number of nearest neighbors that were in the correct region instead of being missing. Okay, so that was the improvement that we made, and then going to the Mercedes design, this trilobe design where we have this additional information in radius, the equivalent plots now have very, very little degeneracy. And this means that your ability to, it is a position reconstruction, but these manifolds don't map one-to-one onto XYZ. Okay, we basically use these manifolds to determine where the events are physically in the crystal, but we simply self-consistently have lookup tables which are in the same manifolds, and then we normalize the properties, for example, of phonon collection or of rise time to some sphere of points around each one of the positions of an event. Okay, so that's the process of so-called correction, which allows us to have all of the rise time information and all of the energy estimates normalized for position in the crystal. Okay. Also, it gives us a sense of position, both in X, Y, and some in Z, which you can compare when you have events. Are those in reasonably central regions, or are they on the edges one way or another? Okay, so is that clear? It's hard to know the exact details, but basically these manifolds, multidimensional manifolds, are the theme in all of the analysis here, that we have an enormous amount of information and you can turn it to your advantage by using it for calibrations, corrections, etc. And you need to do all of that blindly, clearly, before looking at your actual data sets. This is now, we've also been working hard on developing detector Monte Carlos, where we'd like to be able to replicate these kind of manifolds in simulated pulse sets. And once we have done that successfully, then you can go back and actually assign XYZ position information, and also get ideas for how to optimize pulling out the information. Okay, that would be very useful. You can see that we're not perfect yet, so this is the detector Monte Carlo for the new Mercedes design and delay, and now the partitioning is a trilobe because of the three sensors. And the trilobe geometry is similar, but not exactly what we see in the detector, and likewise the delay. And we're continuing to understand the phonon electron hole processes, etc., that need to go into the Monte Carlo in order to understand our detector performance better. And also, as these detector Monte Carlos improve, thinking about a new design for sensors or even geometries can be done in software rather than needing to build each detector and try it. Okay, so that's a very good thing as well.
It wouldn't have been easier just to do the BMW with the circle around, so the five cans.
Say that. You're saying
it would have been easier just to do.
Well, the reason is we want to go into the current infrastructure at Sudan, which is four phonon channels and two charge. Okay, so there's a big, big step in increasing by one the number of channels per detector. Okay. And as we go to Snow Lab, we are going to build a new infrastructure, and we are looking at these bigger detectors having 10 phonon channels, five on each side, and four charge channels. So that will increase the number at that point. Right.
Do you multiplex those channels, or do you read them all up?
For SNOLAB? At Sudan, there's no multiplexing. At SNOLAB, the decision has been made not to multiplex. It looks like we can go through that level in a straightforward fashion. For GODM, there is significant work to use what's been learned in the CMB field, where quite a bit of multiplexing has been going on. We are using one of the CMB advances in the series array, so we have an optimized series array for SNOLAB that looks like it's a substantial improvement over what we're using now. So that's but it's still single channel series array directly to the detector. Okay, and this is one of the detectors running in Super Tower 1, the phonon versus charge yield, and then the delay plot and the triangle and so forth. And we are, after having digested the data sets for CDMS2, we really need to do a much more detailed analysis of Super Tower 1 performance to convince ourselves that it's meeting the objectives in terms of rejection and so forth, right? And that's not been fully done. There's been starts on that.
This is all gamma data?
Right, this is all gamma data. In fact, this is our standard calibration source, which is the barium 133, and you can see the 356 keV line, I think, is the darkest one. And there are several other, the three or four other lines. One at just over 400 keV, and one down closer to 300 something.
Do you have any neutron data yet?
Yes. In fact, let's see. I think this next one here. So this is a neutron data set in one of the Super Tower 1 detectors, and this is after a timing cut applied and before. And in these detectors, by the way, the bulk of the gamma events is shifted in time. You can see that actually in our paper as well, that when you do our timing cut, most of the gamma events are removed. All right, so you can see that clearly here. And most of the neutron events are maintained. Right? So that's just because the neutrons have a larger fraction of intrinsic phonons, which are diffusive, take longer to get to the surface. Their rise times are slower than the gammas that have a significant component of what we call a Luc effect phonons. The phonons shed by the electrons and holes as they move through the lattice, since there are three times more electrons and holes. And that actually moves the entire population to faster rise times, and therefore when you do the rise time cut, you eliminate a lot of the gammas.
So have you quantified yet how much better you're doing than
the surface detailed analysis that have occurred, and I believe these are consistent with that, satisfy what you need for the SNOLAB experiment. Okay, and the thing I would say is that because we've gone to this 2.5 times thicker, there is a significant amount of work to really convince yourself that you're able to reject the surface events sufficiently well, but we can do that with some margin. The iZIP design has huge margin, and so that's one of the reasons that we're very excited about it, that the length of time necessary for analysis is likely to be shorter, particularly in the early phases where you have rejection capability to throw away in some sense. Okay, and in fact, that's what I want to turn to now. So let me introduce this iZIP detector advance, and the I stands for interleaved. I'll go through it in some detail here. So the one that we ran is the same size as the current Sudan Super Tower detectors. So these are 2.5 centimeters thick by 7.5 centimeters in diameter. They have major and minor flats, which are drawn in here. And again, what we chose to do here is we need more than four channels. In fact, in 2005, we tried to make an iZIP design which just had four phonon channels and two charge channels, and we found that there was leakage that necessarily occurred in that design. So this design has actually eight phonon channels and four charge channels, and the way we instrument it, on one surface you have two inner Ds in phonon shown here. On the opposite surface you have two Ds that are orthogonal, so one gives you X information, the other Y. And then just because we had eight channels, we took the ring and broke it into two in the other direction on each face. So we have four phonon channels on the top, four phonon channels on the bottom. Each one of these semicircular outer rings is 25% of the area of one of the Ds. So I'll need that when I talk about one of the And then we're going to have the other important thing to realize in this design, this is our first design, which is totally symmetric top to bottom. So we have phonon sensors on the top and bottom, and charge amplifiers on top and bottom. And the charge bias lines will be plus 2 volts on one side and minus 2 volts on the other side. Okay, and then the photolithographic patterning on each side looks like this. So you can, and we're going to blow this up in just a second. The very thin lines are the charge bias lines. And then between those, with as much of a bare germanium gap as we can muster, so if you make that gap bigger, you get less uniformity in collection of phonons. And if you make it smaller, the capacitance goes up, so your charge measurement becomes less good. Okay? And let's just blow that up. And by the way, the one on the other side will look very similar to this, with the D going the other way, okay, with the split going the other way. And all of these little beads along the lines between the charge lines are going to be phonon sensors. Okay, and so this is now blowing up to the center. You can see the charge line is an 8-micron wide line. All these little dots, by the way, are places to repair a photolithographic defect. If, for example, this charge line had an open there, you can bond from here to here and include it in the electrical circuit. Okay, and likewise, if there's any problem with one of the phonon sensors, each one of these has a TES in the middle. I'll show you a blow up in just a second, too. There are ways in which to jumper from one bias rail to the other. The two bias rails go along the outside here. This connects to one bias rail, that to the other. And so you can actually jumper around the defect as well.
Are those just gold wire bond pads?
These are all aluminum with tungsten on them, and we use aluminum wire bonds. And the detectors run below the aluminum TC.
Transition point.
Right. And just to blow up the one of these phonon sensor regions, again, these are the aluminum collector pads. That's the 1.5 to 2 micron tungsten line. And there's actually quite a bit of attention's been paid to the overlap connection between the tungsten and the aluminum. And again, you want to not make these too long so that you can collect the quasi-particle energy. Okay. And I won't go into this in a lot of detail, but this device, for reasons that we do not entirely understand, collects 4 times more total energy than our CDMS2 devices. Okay, it has 4 times less phonon sensor coverage. The one difference that is true here is that all of this area between the charge and the phonon sensor lines was stripped of its amorphous silicon. Amorphous silicon is applied to all surface areas for the CDMS2 detectors, and it's mostly remains in CDMS2. Here, almost all of it has been etched away because we wanted to have electrical isolation between the charge line and the phonons. The phonons channels run very close to ground. They're just microvolts potential difference between the two rails, whereas this is 2 volts, so this is effectively ground and the charge line. On one side, as I said, this will be a plus 2 volts. On the opposite side, you'll have the phonon channels at ground and the charge lines at minus 2 volts. Okay, so that's the symmetric configuration. All right, and then what electric field arises from this configuration? So again, this is the geometry, and that's a finite element method calculation of the electric field lines, the potential field surfaces and electric field lines. And these zeros correspond to the phonon sensors, so those are at ground potential. And then between them, the pluses correspond to the plus 2 volt, all of them wired in parallel together. On the other side, exactly the same. Well, actually, the mirror image, you have ground occurring every other one and minus potential for the charge line. Okay, and then the way this is instrumented is that two of the charge rails are connected to a separate amplifier on both sides. So there are 4 amplifiers. There's a Q outer top, which has the 2 outer rings all the way around connected to them. All of the inner ones are connected to Q inner top. And then down here, you have a Q outer bottom and a Q inner bottom, same symmetric way. Okay, so those are the 4 charge channel readouts and the 8 phonon sensor readouts I described before. before, right? The two plus half rings on each side, top and bottom. Now, so let's describe a little bit what the philosophy of this detector is. The grayed regions are regions that are going to be vetoed, so the fiducial volume is the lighter color in this plot, okay? And the way it works is that if events occur in the little scallop gray regions, the electrons in whole cloud, one charge goes over to the local charge line, the other charge goes to the ground and doesn't get collected by a charge amplifier. Okay, so you get a signal in the charge amplifier connected, for example, to Q-inner, no signal in the charge amplifier connected to Q-bottom-inner. Okay? Whereas if you have an event in the middle here, and roughly half the field lines are going across the crystal, actually I think a third of them in this calculation, and two-thirds the next nearest neighbor, here the electron hole cloud separates, one sign goes to the plus charge side, the other to the minus, you get equal and opposite pulses in charge in the top and bottom. Okay, so you have a very strong discriminant for bulk events versus very close to the surface of order the scallop scale is about equal to the distance between the lines, okay? And likewise on the other side. And then you notice that the fiducial volume comes all the way to the surface, but of course the electric fields get stronger and stronger there, so your collection efficiency gets better and better in that region, okay?
Something like this has been done by Edelweiss.
Yes, and Edelweiss has a coarser. I mean, the rough history is that in 2005 we built a model and ran it and reported it in LTD. I think 11, something like that. Edelweiss got interested, and they took their NTD where they measure the temperature of the entire with a coarse grid of this and have run it recently and have gotten very good result. And they were reporting on that 2 years ago, actually. And one of the things that slowed down the development of this is if you look at the electric fields, there exists a zero in electric field that occurs right at the top of these scallops. There's a zero of electric field where you must actually fold over from the electric field lines coming to here, going into here, and then coming into here back to there. There's a zero right there. So the fear was that events occurring close to those zeros of electric field would have trapped charge that would cause essentially a reduction in the collection. And the suspicion some of us had was that the crystals are so clean in away from surfaces that the diffusion of the charges will get through that low field region. That appears to be the case. But that needed to be demonstrated. The Edelweiss results have demonstrated that. Okay. And then we came back and built more channels so that we could avoid the leakage that we had from this outer surface. So four charge and six, but we were instrumenting eight phonon channels in this particular. And this is working extremely well. So that we've actually been able to demonstrate substantially more rejection capability than Edelweiss has so far.
There's also some history from germanium photon detectors.
So the original idea, I gave a talk in the collaboration 1998, and this was after reading a paper by Paul Luke that for cadmium telluride crystals where the collection was very poor, he'd come up with this idea of scallop fields close to the surface to reject surface events. And then I was realizing that it's very straightforward to do this on both surfaces, and this would really be a good idea. And 98 was a long time ago, and we were actually pushing very hard to get CDMS2, fully going. So that's always been the interesting. But anyway, I think this is a very, very powerful technology and relatively straightforward to implement. And I'll show you more about the results. So these are data then from the detector that we built and ran this summer. And this is now the charge on left, right means one side. So we'll call that, say, the top, and or maybe this one the top and this one the bottom. And the only difference between the left and the right is in one, the top is plus 2 and the bottom minus 2, and the other, the top is minus 2 and the top plus 2. So you basically reverse the direction of the field. Okay, and I'll come back and talk a little bit about, there is clearly a really interesting asymmetry where you have the 356K line, substantially better resolution with one sign of potential than in the other, and exactly the same crystal, when you reverse the potential, it goes the other way. Okay, and that's a really interesting property of the propagation of electrons and holes in germanium. And then the other thing we did, which was very important for the demonstration of surface rejection, is we had 100 hertz cadmium 109, so it was producing about 100 events per second, right in the surface. It's a beta emitter, so it produces lots and lots of electrons all over the one surface of the detector. And it also produces a couple of x-rays. The x-rays you see in the streaming lines that go into the interior, because they penetrate in. The all of the beta emission occurs, and I think these are x-rays here too, occurs in the surface layer. So basically all of these events, and there are 20 times as many of these as there are of the gammas that are occurring along the central bulk line, and that's already indicating that the discrimination is quite good, and then we'll go through the numbers on that. Okay, so I'll come back to, and now let's describe, that this is just too much fun here, so I can't avoid going into pulses. We have four channels on each side, and so here's an event where we've made a cut in the charge channels to pull out an event that was close to one surface. Okay, so it was close to this top surface. We got a large signal in the phonon channel under which the event occurred. And the opposite face had smaller signals. It's further away. Okay, and now the important thing to realize here, and this is one of the powers of this superconducting sensor technology, is we get an absolute energy measurement on how much energy is absorbed in each sensor. And so this vertical plot is in picowatts. This is real picowatts calculated from first principles, knowing the resistances and all of the parameters of the sensor. And this is microseconds. So if I multiply microseconds times picowatts, I get absorbed energy in the sensor, okay, the total integral. And the other thing I've done here is the two outer rings, which have four times less energy, I'm sorry, less area, we multiplied by four. Okay, and what's it? So therefore the two outer rings don't really have the right scale here. It's been multiplied by four. The reason for doing that, though, is we found it striking that this detector, which has about 900 microsecond decay times, okay, has two regimes. We've never seen the second regime. The first regime, going out to about 500 microseconds, has position dependence. All right, where each of the phonon sensors has a different pattern. You absorb more in the one that's directly under where the event occurred and less in the one that's furthest away. But then there's a second regime past 500 microseconds where all of the energy in the entire crystal becomes homogenized, and that decay time is common to all sensors. Okay, in CDMS2, the entire decay time is about 350 to 400 microseconds. We never see the second regime. Okay. And why is a second regime important? Well, it's hugely beneficial to understanding the detector Monte Carlo business, for example, because we can now pull away what's happening with the phonon signal versus what's happening in the transition edge sensor dynamics, for example. Okay.
You haven't seen this before because it's more for silicon?
Say that again?
Why didn't you see the long
tail? Well, I think the long tails here are because we have four times less coverage. Okay, so we collect all the phonons in the CDMS2 in about, say, 400 microseconds and 350 to 400. We have four times less coverage, and so that's producing this longer tail. And it means that the phonons are rattling around. These are not thermal. They're not thermalized yet. They're still plenty energetic to couple to the aluminum, for example. They're not thermal. They're often called gray. They're essentially uniformly distributed, not thermal, right? Right. And then the other thing to point out, and I'll go into that in the next slide as well, is that the top and bottom scales are also exactly the same. And the one of the not good aspects of this detector fabrication step was that one side had a transition temperature which was anomalously low, it was 46 millikelvin. The other side had the more standard transition temperature of about 100 millikelvin. So it's almost a factor of two difference in TC, and you can still pull out the true energy absorbed and you get the same answer. Okay, so that was very powerful. It gave us, it's sort of serendipitous that we had this big difference in TC. Both sides were very uniform, by the way, but different by this large amount. So again, we can easily pull out the sensor effects, which vary with TC, versus the phonon physics effects internal. Okay, so this is really, really neat. And here's another event over here, by the way, in which it was close to the other surface. Did I get that right? It almost looks like it replicated the same one twice. Closer to the other surface. And what happens here is because this low TC side has a much longer, what's called tau TE, electrothermal feedback time, it rolls off the sharp peak. Okay, and so you don't see the sharp peak on the side that that has the lower TC. And okay, so now the next step, let's add all the four sensors on the top and all the four sensors on the bottom. And again, the sum, in this case now, we have added them properly, so the ones that had four times less area contributed the proper amount of energy. And again, you see that it comes to a common curve, top and bottom. And this is the one, the red is the one with the lower TC at about 46 millikelvin. And the blue is the one with the high TC, higher TC at about 105 millikelvin, where you see the roughly 20 microsecond tau ETF versus roughly 60 microsecond tau ETF in the lower one. Okay, and we tried something that we don't often do, which is let's deconvolute. Signal to noise look pretty good. And so we basically deconvoluted both transition edge sensor time constants to the same about 10 microsecond integration time. Okay, and this worked remarkably well. We now then recovered from the 60 microsecond ETF that had sufficient signal to noise to deconvolute it into a 10 microsecond rise time. So let's go back to the previous one here. So this one in blue, which was sharp, remains about as sharp, so it went up to 2, and you can see now that it's going up a little higher than 2. And the one that's in red in the previous slide, you can see that it was not peaked very high at about 1.25, and now with the deconvolution algorithm, that goes up also to a similar height. Okay, so again, this is telling us that we're able to successfully deconvolute and recover the true phonon arrival flux as a function of time. Right, so it's very cute. Now the next step that we're going to do is let's add the top and bottom together to get the total pulse for the entire detector.
Right? Ross, what's the base temperature?
The base temperature of the fridge is running at about 35 millikelvin. Okay, so it's actually, normally you like to be a factor of 2 below TC, so we're somewhat closer to that 46, which is actually one of the reasons the tau ETF was somewhat longer. It's also longer because the lower TC intrinsically causes it to be longer too. And the nominal detector that we want for dark matter would have a transition temperature of about 70 to 80 millikelvin, and we'd be running the crystal at about 40 millikelvin. So that's sort of the typical.
How are you tuning the TC in this case?
The TC, and we've actually tuned the high, the 105 TC side has been tuned to 80 millikelvin. We do that by ion implantation of iron. And we don't have a good way to pull it up, but we have a very good way to pull it down. So parts per million iron can tune in a very controllable way the TC of the tungsten, and we do that routinely. We actually do understand what happened in the deposition of having this lower TC, and we know how to avoid that, but that's one of the process control issues always. The TC is very important to have stable. Even more important to have uniform across, because this tuning capability of iron implanting is easiest to do just as a one parameter instead of trying to get some gradient out. OK, Okay, so then what I was going to say now, if I add, so this is an event very close to the top, for example, and an event very close to the bottom, and have now very similar pulse shapes. And if we now add them together, the remarkable thing, we've essentially taken a set of pulses which actually span the position in the ratio of charge. So this is kind of the angle and the ratio of charge from all on one side to all on the other side. And it's remarkable that all of these guys with similar intervals have similar pulse shapes. Okay, so we actually believe that these detectors, in terms of the energy resolution that we get from everything summed together, and then the position information we get from looking at the relative amounts in each of the individual sensors, is going to be very powerful. Okay, so we're just sort of looking, and this is looking at that front edge. The front edge does have peaks occurring when the devices are close to the surface, and somewhat less peaks when they occur further in the bulk. Now let me, so what do we do with this information? And this is now where we have this new charge discriminant, which is what do you see in the top versus the bottom? So that's a new one. And we have our old discriminants. Well, actually, we have a second new one, which is we have phonon sensors on the top and the bottom. So how much energy is collected in the top versus the bottom? That's kind of a phonon discriminant for being close to the surface. And there's the third one, which is the one we used to use for CDMS2, which is the rise time information, timing information. Okay, and our expectation was that the timing information would be reduced in quality over CDMS2 because we have four times less coverage, and so therefore the phonons would be collected on a longer period of time and lose more of that leading edge information. What happened instead was that because we were collecting more total energy than we had in the past, we actually end up with better timing discrimination as well as the new phonon discrimination and the new charge discrimination. So there are three independent, mostly independent. I'll say a little bit about what we know about the correlations. So just to look quickly at these plots, here we're plotting a timing discriminant along the x-axis. And so this, for example, is the difference in arrival time on one face versus the other face versus the angle in charge. So the angle in charge is looking at that 2D plot. What's the angle of the point in the quadrant? Okay. And so in this plot here, you see events occurring close to one face, events in the bulk, and events occurring close to the other face. The red points are the ones that are tagged by the charge cut, and this is the cadmium. So when we run the cadmium source, the points are all on one side. And there are some surface electrons hitting the other side just from backgrounds, et cetera, that you see up here. So that's the very good charge discrimination. Along this axis, the delay time gives you not so good but still pretty good identification of events in the bulk versus events on one face versus events on the other face. Okay? So that's timing, comparing it against the charge. Here also against the charge, so this axis is the same in both plots. And now what we have down here, let's look at the total energy absorbed on the bottom face versus the total energy absorbed on the top face. And again, you have pretty good separation in terms of events that are close on to one face versus the other. You also have a kind of intriguing bulk variation, which we need to understand better to see how much direct Z information you have in the bulk as well, right, from this detector. And then if we look at the standard yield, so here's what that looks like. Remember, all of this data was taken in the surface facility. So this is events close to the surface of the crystal being taken in a facility on the surface of the Earth, right? Just to get straight. And the blue dots are the gamma band. And the very high density of black dots comes from this cadmium source, so it hits the surface, and it does have a somewhat depressed, but actually pretty good, that most of that rain cloud doesn't come into the nuclear recoil band, it stays above it. And by the way, that's a big difference from what Edelweiss was showing. They actually were showing rain clouds that did move into the nuclear recoil band, so they need very good rejection from this surface charge interleave in order to eliminate those. Here we have very few points that rain down into the nuclear recoil band. In fact, they've been labeled, the green ones here are the ones that are in the nuclear recoil band and that are symmetric in Q, so those actually probably are neutrons for generated by muons in our surface facility, surface of the Earth facility. And let's see, what are the other ones here? So symmetric Q low yield, so these are the ones, so the way we chose to do our leakage estimate is to say, let's cut out the nuclear recoil band because we know we have neutrons, so that's going to limit how well we do. Let's look at the region above the nuclear recoil band and below the three sigma line in gammas and see how many events occur there. Okay, and that are in the interior part, so that's why all these black dots are eliminated, because they're eliminated by the Q cut. And so we have essentially one down in here, and then a few that are up close to the edge. Okay.
Sorry, what's the blue dashed line compared to the
blue dashed line, I believe that's the three sigma gamma position. Okay, and this line here is either the one, or I think that's the one sigma, and I believe this is the two sigma for the gammas, yep. And these are the betas, which are rejected from the charge partition. Okay, so we're able to make the most stringent rejection estimate based on this in-between region where we don't have neutrons. Okay, and that's the three estimates then from these kind of data at the surface are here. You can argue there's a yield leakage of 1 in 3,000, less than 1 in 3,000. We can't do any better because we're at the surface. There's the Q symmetric of at least 1 in 1,000. Okay, and there is the phonon, using the phonon signal for 1 in 3,000. Now, if all of these were independent, then we would have a demonstration of 1 in 10 billion. We don't believe that they're all independent. In fact, going the other extreme, we do believe we can argue, as I say here, that that yield leakage anti-correlates with Q and P, and then if you simply assume Q and P totally correlate, then you would multiply the first and the second, for example, to get the 1 in 3 million. Okay, so that's kind of the range that we believe, once you understand the correlations in detail, you'll be somewhere between those two. Okay, but still, the numbers we have now, for example, for surface rejection and CDMS2 are about 1 in 200, you know, just for kind of setting the scale.
Okay. And is it, what are the purple dots on the left, the N0?
Right, and I was just trying to remember that myself. So let's see, so this is symmetric N0, and these may be N0s that are not in the bulk. Symmetric means they're in the bulk, right? And N0 means in general, everywhere. So everything that's in the nuclear recoil band, whether or not it's in the bulk, and the red ones are, I'm sorry, the green ones are the ones that are in the bulk from the charge cut. Okay, so we're only going to look at the ones that are outside the nuclear recoil band, and that's this guy here, symmetric in Q, and low yield means between the nuclear recoil band and this 3 gamma point. Okay, now, like always, there's very interesting stuff that comes out of this, and one of them is we often plot the ratio of charge to phonon on one face versus the other face. Actually, sorry, Q inner versus Q outer. So this is like we did in CDMS2. We have the inner charge collection divided by the total phonon signal versus the outer charge collection divided by the total phonon signal. Our expectation is all those points for gammas, for electron recoils, should line up very close to 1 when they're fully Q inner and very close to 1 on the other axis when they're fully Q outer. And then there should be some band of shared events which correspond to clouds that partly are collected in Q inner and partly collected in Q outer. One of the things that surprised us is that if we look at the opposite sign of charge, so this occurs when we have holes being pulled towards the face where we're looking at Q inner versus Q outer. Okay, if we look at the opposite, what happens when electrons are pulled towards the face where we have Q inner versus Q outer? We have this dramatic difference. We call this a funnel, actually. And not only is there this feature in the middle of the 45-degree line, but when we make a histogram, we see that the total number of events that are shared are almost an order of magnitude larger for electrons pulled towards the boundary between the two than for holes. Okay, and so that led us to conceptually believe that when an event occurs, electrons move in a much bigger fan than holes the other way. Okay. All right, now why is that? Well, okay, so let me just give you a little bit of introduction to condensed matter here. Both silicon and germanium, this is silicon and this is germanium, and this is the momentum space, are what are called indirect semiconductors, and what that means is that in the conduction band, the lowest lying states are not at zero momentum, whereas for holes, the lowest lying states are at zero momentum. Okay, and so there are these so-called valleys, which for germanium occur on the 1-1-1 axes and actually are right at the zone boundaries. So the other half of this ellipse is in the next boundary over. And for silicon occur on the 1-0-0 axes and actually are contained within the zone. Okay, so if you put in a cloud of electrons and holes, they rapidly relax by phonon emission or colliding with other electrons, producing more electron-hole pairs, and then they settle into these valleys. Okay, now these valleys have the property, and I think I show that here, that they're highly anisotropic. The constant energy surfaces in momentum space are ellipses, and that's kind of the model that's usually used to characterize a transverse and a parallel effective mass, and then assume that the elliptical approximation is sufficiently good. Okay, for germanium, those numbers are actually staggering. The parallel effective mass is close to the mass of the electron, but the perpendicular one is almost 20 times smaller. So there's a ratio of 20 to 1 in effective mass. Okay. Now, normally in semiconductor physics, this large anisotropy disappears, and you just look at an average mass for various transport properties. The reason is that you have sufficient energy available; the transitions between these valleys can occur relatively frequently. Okay, and so if you do averages over these valleys, because they're symmetrically positioned in momentum space, they look very similar to an isotropic distribution. Right? But if you're in the regime we're in, where you do not have enough energy, either in temperature or in electric field, for these inner valley transitions to occur, then when the original electron cloud relaxes, all of the electrons that are present in each one of these independent valleys is not free to transfer from one to another. And so now you have to understand the dynamics of the electrons in each valley, and that's what really becomes striking, because you can no longer do this average over all the valleys. And just very simply, it's still true that if you have an electric field in the crystal, that produces a rate of momentum change in the same direction. All right, but now the mass is a tensor instead of a scalar, and so what you have is that the momentum vector does not point in the same direction as the velocity vector. Okay, so you have this really strange thing where the electric field is along 1-0-0, the valleys are along 1-1-1, and there's a velocity vector that's close to perpendicular 1-1-1, about 30 degrees off from 1-0-0. Okay, so that's just a simple. All right, and then you can actually calculate, and it's actually, because the ratio is not infinite, there's about 2 degrees from this perpendicular direction back in the direction of the electric field. And that ends up being about 30. 30 degrees. Now, if you then do, let's just do a simple Monte Carlo. So this is a toy Monte Carlo where we don't have the full semiconductor physics. We're just saying that the electrons are confined to moving in this plane that's perpendicular, that's along this drift velocity calculated direction. And there are four of these valleys, and therefore, for each cloud of events that occurs, so this is the thickness of the crystal, and here's the outer charge and the inner charge, for example. And there's a cloud of electrons and holes. The holes are assumed to propagate in parallel trajectories to one face. And the size of this spread has been set so that the number of shared events when holes go in that direction are about right. So that kind of says all of the straggling that may occur in the real physics has been put into the initial condition, and you just have an approximate solution. And then for the electrons, you assume that the four groups move along each of these perpendiculars to the anisotropic inner valley ellipses. And so that forms this kind of fan. The further it has to go, the bigger that fan is, and the shorter. So here's one that started way up close to the top. You have a big fan. And then the other thing we've done in this simple simulation is when those electrons go and hit the outer surface, they get stuck. That's the green dots. That's where an electron has been stuck, doesn't make it over to the other one. That's why the funnel comes in from the 45 degree line, because some of the charges don't get all the way across. You get a smaller signal. Okay? And if you then just carry this Monte Carlo through, when you pull the holes towards the upper surface, you get this plot for the charge collected in the outer divided by the phonon total versus the inner 45 degree line. You get this kind of approximate funnel. It's, you know, we haven't put all the physics in, but you very easily get this large increase in the shared events for this flaring out. By the way, you can quickly convince yourself that the peak in the histogram here can only happen if the distribution of electrons has a hole in the middle, okay? Not a hole as an electron hole, but a hole as in lower density in the middle, okay? And if that doesn't occur, then all of your histograms are going to be a curvature without a chain, without an inflection point. So having this peak, and you can kind of see the limit of where you have four blobs that are separated, you have a significant probability of two being inside and two outside. That corresponds to a peak at zero. And the horizontal axis here is always the charge in the inner minus the charge in the outer divided by the total charge. So an event in the inner occurs as one, event in the outer occurs as minus one. Okay. So again, in a very simple model, it really is kind of pointing to this. We're going back into the 50s and 60s and 70s semiconductor books and actually putting in the simulation, a more realistic model for shedding the phonons in these elliptical anisotropic valleys. And you can go all the way through Fermi's golden rule. It's really neat physics.
I'm just wondering, you split the top circle in those two areas.
Right.
Is that perpendicular or somehow crystal orientation? Meaning the spreading of the electron
cloud. Yes, so I'll say a little bit more. This crystal assumes the surface is 100. Okay, so the crystalline direction perpendicular to the surface is 100. And roughly this inner and outer is the size of the inner and outer that's in the current ISIP. So that's why it's that big. Okay.
I'm sorry, no, but that's, I meant like, if you go back a slide, the electron spread in this squarish rectangular area.
Yes.
So my question is, how is the splitting of the circular area in respect to that axis? Is it symmetric or is it perpendicular or not oriented?
Yeah, it's symmetric, so it really is a circle. So if we had geometries which went, for example, split this along this direction versus this, you'd be able to say more about whether that fan. Yeah, and we have not done that yet. Yes, the one thing we are doing is, and by the way, you could actually ask that question by using the phonon information to get a population of points, that, for example, over in here, and then see what that histogram looks like versus a population of points that's at the 45 degree. So that, you know, that can be done by using your phonon information to look for events that are in particular regions around the circle. Right? That's a good idea.
Might even be a very crude way to measure your crystal orientation.
Right. Right. And then just coming back to, you know, I kind of alluded to the fact that we had an asymmetry here depending on whether the electric field went one way or another. It is also interesting to take these two and superimpose them. Okay. And what you see is that the true 45 degree line is actually common, and then you get this streak that goes either one way or another depending on the electric field. And our belief is that this is exactly the same effect as due to this electron flaring. And the reason is that as the charges move into the region close to the surface where you have these scallop fields, the holes follow the field lines pretty well, so you get fairly efficient collection of the holes into the charge channel. The electrons, on the other hand, as they go into these low field regions where the electric fields are changing, are not moving along the electric field, and some significant number of them actually splash over into the ground loop. So you get a deficit in the electron collection when the electrons are being pulled over towards this sensor. So I guess this is the one here, which would show a smear in the collection when the electrons are going towards here, and the holes then show a sharp. Okay. And we have not gone through the detailed modeling of that, but I'm pretty sure that effect will be there from the same not moving obliquely, as we call it.
But you understand the band structure well enough to say this fact about the valleys for the electrons.
Yes, right. So that's typical, and there actually is much more complete band structure calculations, but really just that kernel of these elliptical surfaces in close to the minimum being a good approximation. It's kind of like the parabolic approximation close to a minimum. That served most of these calculations very well. So we're going to carry that through, assuming that the energies are sufficiently low to stay within that elliptical region. You can also then expand the calculations using a more complete band structure to, as you turn up the electric field, you begin to allow transitions between valleys. And those kind of codes are out there. In fact, one of the Berkeley graduate students has been working on that as well. Okay, so anyway, it's the theme here is there's really a neat amount of physics in this anisotropic germanium, and you need to understand enough of it. So what happens, when do we start using iZip? And this is actually an ongoing discussion. The original plan was to run 25 detectors of what we call the MZip, the Mercedes Zip. We've made two of the super towers, and the next three super towers would be made the same way. That would be 25 detectors. Okay, and several review committees have said, you've been so successful with iZip, why don't you at least have one of these towers converted to iZip? Okay. And so the way that would be done is, remember, we need twice as many phonon and charge channels, which means that you could run three of these new iZips in one super tower with the same hardware. Okay. And so the intriguing aspect when you go through the calculations is that because of how good the surface rejection is, even in just charge alone for the purpose of the next step, you gain fiducial volume sufficiently rapidly that three of these iZips have somewhat more than the fiducial volume in five of the MZip. Okay. So you don't lose fiducial volume by going to the three iZip tower. The other proposal, which I think is an important one, is to carefully make a lead-210 source, which has about 1 to 2,000 decays per day. That should easily be handleable in the rejection capability of the detector, and it allows you to directly document rejection capability sufficient for the 100 kilogram and the ton scale experiment of the future. Okay, so that's the proposal, to have at least one tower like this. We're also discussing whether do we do two towers like that or possibly three towers like that. Okay, so that's the current the current discussion.
And when could those go in?
Well, that's of course part of the discussion. So you don't want to delay things for that to go in. So, for example, one camp of the discussion is that we run 3 of the MZIP and have it as early as possible in the summer. Starting in the summer, we start a run with those 3. That becomes an interesting science for each with a six-month run, something like that. You're fabricating and preparing 2 to 3 ISIP towers, and then you stop and include those. Maybe replacing Super Tower 1 if it's not running as well as the other 2 or something like that. The other possibility is that we go for 1 or 2 ISIP towers and we can fabricate them sufficiently quickly that there's only a small delay in starting 1 run instead of splitting a run into 2. Okay, and that discussion is going on now. It needs to converge very quickly because we are now writing what's called this project execution document. It's PEP, I don't know where the P stands, the second P, but anyway, for the DOE, and we need to specify what we're going to do exactly, right? And it's possible to change these things in the future, but it's much easier to get it reasonably correct at the beginning.
When did you have the first tower, ISIP tower?
Well, the idea is under any scenario, we probably would build the next round of ISIP starting in the next round, so that would be January or late January, something like that. And then we either go back to making more of the MZIP or we continue making ISIP, but that would give the test facilities a couple of examples of what we believe we can make and that the final decision on how many or when they're deployed could await the results of the test facility. Okay, and then the Snow Lab experiment, 100 kilogram experiment, 84 of these ISIP detectors, so these are now bigger detectors, 10 centimeters in diameter, 3.3 centimeters thick. That's 1.4 kilograms. And Snow Lab is great. It goes from this roughly 0.01 neutrons per year per kilogram to less than 1 per year per ton. So, you know, that's where you want to be. And we have quite a bit of engineering that's already been done, so it's a scaled up version of the facility we have. The main additional change, actually let me point out 2 main changes. The inner lead and poly is inside the vacuum. That allows us to make the vacuum out of aluminum instead of copper, which is significantly easier. Okay, and the second one is that instead of using the open cryogenics, so open liquid helium, liquid nitrogen system, we used a closed system which does not require replenishing the helium and nitrogen. So this is a pulse tube cooler dilution refrigerator system. So those are the 2 main ideas. And that's this 100 kilogram here. That's the 15 kilogram that we talked about at Sudan. And then maybe just one last slide here. The Dussel idea of the ton and a half scale is we have to wait for Dussel to become real, and it doesn't make sense to go into the shallower site, so that means you want to wait for the 7,400 foot level. That's currently planned for 2017 occupancy, and you know, my own feeling is that'll almost certainly slide. So again, this is why it's so important to be doing the next round at Snow Lab. And as I said, though, there's the very strange thing that we have money for R&D development of GODM. That, by the way, stands for Germanium Observatory for Dark Matter. Okay. And that we're deploying it in such a way as it makes sense, so it contributes to what is needed for the Snow Lab project, but also in items which scale to what would be needed for GODM. So that's the way we've approached it. And just to summarize, so the near zero background strategy is very successful, and we believe it's vital for maintaining discovery potential. 15 kilogram flu sensitivity by another factor of 5, and you know, after yesterday, we're just as excited as everybody else about getting to that sooner rather than later. And it allows probing the central region of supersymmetry and very complementary to LHC and indirect detection and over this next several years. We're very excited by the interleave detector technologies, and it really enables not just a very straightforward forgetting about surface rejection as being the main theme, as it's been for us for some time, but it enables 100 kilogram and the ton scale, even from what we were able to demonstrate at the surface, and we expect it actually to be better than that. Okay, thanks.
More questions?
So is it believed that the amorphous silicon on the old ZIS was dampening phonons and absorbing them?
Well, it's that we're trying to kind of see what possible explanations there are for the roughly four times additional collection. So we are looking at those absolute power curves. In CDMS2, we collect about 5% of the total energy deposited in a crystal in the TESs, and here we're collecting about 20%. So that's that factor of four. And the two main places we're looking at are the amorphous silicon, and then also there's a somewhat improved aluminum fin geometry where they're closer distances to the TES. So those are the two places that we think are most likely to be contributing, but we'd like to understand that better clearly.
So do you have to redo all this planning and what cuts and so on you're doing?
In terms of the iZIP detector? Yeah, let me kind of scale it this way, that for the detector which demonstrated the rejection for what we call the MZIP, so the thicker detector that went into the proposal for the 15 kilogram, that was a lot of work. So, you know, there were several months of very careful calibration, correction with the lookup tables and so forth. iZIP in about 3 days, okay, we exceeded that rejection with the first things that we tried, right? So it is dramatically easier to analyze iZIP because the discrimination is so good, right? So I think that's the main message, that with MZIP, we actually have to pull many of the tools available to us out of the bag in order to get into the interesting rejection capabilities. With iZIP, particularly for the 15 kilogram experiment, almost anything you try immediately gets you there, right? So that's a good position to be in. That's right.
Will the threshold be lower for iZIP?
Because of the factor of four, it's in principle four times lower. We'll see whether that comes all the way through. Remember, that's the phonon channels are four times lower. In many ways, yield is going to limit you to the charge noise, and that's already dominating. So for yield purposes, you won't get as much of a gain. But still, having more phonon signal noise is always a good thing.
What's the price tag? 15 versus 100 versus 1500. How's that?
Well, let's see. So the current project, $2.5 million, I think, is the what's called the Super CDMS Sudan project, and that's the one where we're coming up with this PEP. And of course, the facility was already built. Actually, the first two super towers were built on this R&D project. So there's that. Have to actually think about what the total number would be there, and you have to spread it out over the other project too. Snow Lab, in which you're building its whole new facility and new detectors, we're talking PASAG heard a number like $25 million. Okay. And GODM, we believe 50 million scale is the scale, and you need to do a lot more work in terms of ramping up yield and fabrication capabilities. That's the question. And that, in fact, is for the S4 proposal, that's one of the themes, is what do you need to do to lay out a factor of 10 faster rate of producing the detectors. The one interesting question is what's the cost, and we're in the ballpark of 20,000, so 10,000 per kilogram, right? Right. So a ton spends $10 million on the germanium part, $50 million overall. And likely you get a deal when you buy a larger amount. Right.
Yeah. So in general, how do you improve as you go to lower temperature?
There is a sweet spot, so you're going to low temperature for the transition position means means that it takes less energy to destroy superconductivity, so you continue to gain roughly as a square root of temperature in the TES signal to noise. But the trade-off is that there's also a rapid slowing down of the processes. And so if you want to follow the phonon physics, which kind of you like the microsecond to at least a few microsecond time scale, then getting much colder than where we are at about 70 millikelvin or so starts making the TES. You could see that at the 46 millikelvin, we had kind of 60 microsecond a convolution coming from the TES. And so that makes it harder to look at leading edge information that's, say, faster than 10 microseconds or so. Right? So we like this position at about the 70 millikelvin as being the compromise between having improved the sensitivity to high level and still having a fast response.
But your germanium is running at 35, or is that your...
Yeah, you typically run a factor of 2 down. And of course, that was the big breakthrough with transition head sensors, was that you self-bias them with their Joule heating, internal Joule heating. And that's self-stabilizing, which means you can bring the entire array into the sensitive region with a voltage bias. And that was, that basically made all this possible. So before that, we were working to carefully tune the temperature in the middle of the transition. And the transition had sufficient gradient across the wafer that there wasn't a unique temperature to do that. That's what led to this idea of the voltage biasing. And then suddenly everything became much easier. Just like the operational amplifier turned the transistor, which is an extremely high gain, very nonlinear device, into a very easy to plan linear device, but with a lower gain. Right? You gave up gain and negative feedback, and similar things happened with the TES. So you have less gain, but enormously easier to use in practice.
All right. Thanks, Mas.
Okay.
Just yet. Okay.
Make sure that you know all the things that you have to know. Okay. Right.
Yeah,
I can sit down. Yeah. And then I can take the microphone off.
Something that I thought you all might want to know is that last night I heard a rumor that
Xenon, some events, not many, but you didn't hear from me.
You didn't hear from me.
John had a runoff for this.
A few things, just to remind you of before you go. If you started any collaborations or came up with any theories to explain your predictions for CDMS, please be sure to acknowledge the KATP or any or all collaborations or work that was assisted by your participation in being here. Some administrative things. Remember to return your keys, as was described in the email. This is a little ambiguous. Don't actually return your keys through email. Take your tape off of your mug and wash that and leave that in the kitchen. You were all sent emails about this, so you can refer to them about exactly what you should be doing. But please pay attention to that, because the holidays are about to start, and there's not going to be a lot of people around to sort of, you know, clean up of this if we don't do our parts to make sure everything goes smoothly. So let me also thank people. Want to thank David and the KATP. They were great in supporting us and encouraging this program to happen. Marty, you don't know this, but you don't see how much he's doing behind the scenes, but I've exchanged about something like 500,000 emails with him as he was handling all sorts of things that you don't know about. And of course, we're tremendously indebted to the support staff, Timber, Deborah, Anna, Drew, Kevin, and then of course Simona, who was our impromptu AV support. Lastly, most importantly, thanks to all of you guys. It was a great workshop, and it was really great because the people who were here were great, and everybody really went all in. So thanks all to you, and I look forward to seeing you all the next time we do this. So thanks for coming. That's it.
Neil and Nima and Doug, they did a fantastic job.